Welcome to Unity Fort Worth Online. We are a spiritual center of love and wisdom, affirming God's presence in our lives and reaching the larger community in ever-increasing circles of good.
I'd like to introduce our guest speaker for today. He has traveled the last 40 years around the nation speaking in churches just like this one, Unity Churches and Churches of Science of the Mind, delivering a very powerful and dynamic message. Brace yourselves. I could go on and try to tell you more about him, but I think it's best to leave that up to him. So without further ado, please welcome Terry McBride.
Good morning. It's an honor for me to stand in your presence. How many of you have not heard me speak before? Raise your hand. Well, have fun. If I was talking to you one-on-one, the first thing I'd do is find out what books have you read? What trainings have you taken? What words and concepts are you familiar with as we explore this idea of being God in form? And then we could do this whole thing based on the words you're familiar with, the concepts you're used to using. But since my people were all Montana people and I got a little country in me, which some of you from Texas may be able to identify with, there's a good chance as I get on a roll this morning, I might say something that's a little different than you're used to. I might quote scripture different or tell a story different. And all I would ask is if we run into a place where there's a little difference, please look past it, because I guarantee you my sole intention this morning is to remind each of us how absolutely magnificent and powerful we are right now. Now, given that, and I will shorten it up a little bit this service, when there's this many people who haven't heard me before, I tell a little story about how I got into Unity. What I call the practical application of the teachings of Jesus. When I was 23, I hurt my back. I was working construction in the summertime between college semesters. A year later, I had a spinal fusion. During surgery, my spine got infected with the E. coli bacteria. E. coli is a bad bug, and it was worse 40 years ago. This orthopedic guy said the only way to get it out is to cut it out. So over the next year, he did four surgeries to cut it out. Finally, on that last one, he said he just opened me up, sewed me back up, and said, look, this is way out of my league. You need more than one primary care physician. So he transferred me to the University of Washington Medical Center in Seattle, where I live. He said, they got all the experts under one roof that you'll need. I went in there and became a real celebrity within a couple of days. Turned out I had the worst case of osteomyelitis of the spine they'd ever seen. My doctor became this visiting professor from England. Supposed to be the number three orthopedic surgeon in the whole world. The other professors didn't talk like that, but the interns and residents did. And this guy's kind of, I thought he was kind of standoffish and arrogant. He said, you know, the only way to get E. coli is to cut it out, so when we do this debridement, I don't want to be blindsided, so we're going to do tests. And I, okay, I was used to tests. So for 2 weeks, they did tests. They poked me in places I didn't even know I had places. Finally, he came in one afternoon with his resident and three or four interns, and when he came in that afternoon, he was different. He wasn't quite as arrogant. I wasn't into feelings then. I was a construction worker, but something was going on. And he said, look, we got great x-rays, but it's more involved than I ever imagined, so I'm going to have a meeting tomorrow with some other specialists, and then we'll, after the meeting, we'll tell you what to do. Okay. About an hour later, my wife came in, and the first thing she said was, what's going on? I said, what do you mean? She said, when I came down the hall, the nurses wouldn't look at me. They all turned around and walked away. What's happened? And I said, I don't know. They got good x-rays. That's all I know. Next day, she came with our two-year-old daughter, and we waited for the meeting. 5 o'clock came and went. Nobody showed up. 6 o'clock came and went. 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, finally quarter after eight, door to my private room opened up, and in walks six surgeons. And if it's good news, there's one person to tell you. Guy in lead was this orthopedic guy from England. Behind him, head of the Department of General Surgery. Behind him, head of the Department of Infectious Disease. Behind them, the three top residents. And this is what they said. They took a lot longer. The infection has spread. It's no longer just in those two vertebrae where you had just fusion. It's throughout. It's up and down your spine. It's throughout your pelvic area. It's throughout your abdomen. It's followed both your sciatic nerves into your thighs. And we think the E. coli has eaten holes in your colon so that the germs are communicating back and forth. And he said, Terry, if we don't stop this now, you'll die. He didn't say it that way. He said, this has now become life-threatening, which means if we don't stop this now, you're going to die. So tomorrow we're going to take you down to the operating theater and the first of general surgeons are going to start from the front. They're going to start as low as they can go down here in your pelvic area. We're going to come up around your belly button and go up almost to your sternum. We're going to open all that up. We're going to cut out all the infected tissue, separate your organs out of the way. And when we get on the spine, the orthopedic surgeons will take over and chisel and scrape the infection out of your spine. When we're done with that, we're going to roll you over, and the orthopedic surgeons are going to start. They're going to start as low as they go down here in your buttocks. We're going to come up mid-back. We're going to open all that up, cut all the infected tissue, chisel and scrape the infection out of your spine. When we're done with that, two teams of surgeons are going to start at your belt line, open up both your buttocks, follow your sciatic nerves into your thighs. And when we're done with that, we're going to tip you up on the end and come in from the bottom. He got about 3 minutes into that, and I just started shaking. My body knew what they were going to do. They were going to gut me like a dead deer. When he got done, he grabbed a chair and pulled it up next to my bed and reached out and took my hand. And that's when I knew I was in trouble, because this guy was not a touchy-feely doctor. And he said, son, I know how radical this must seem, but we've got to stop this now. When we're done with the debridement, the drains, and the antibiotics that we do have, we're pretty sure we can stop it from spreading anymore. The bad news is that we can virtually guarantee you you are going to lose the use of your left leg through nerve damage. And then he just looked at me. And I just looked at him. And he just looked at me. And I figured it must be my turn to say something. And I heard come out of my own mouth, that's okay. That's okay. If we've got to do this, let's just get it over with. But even as I heard those words come out of my mouth, I thought, what has happened to me? What has happened that in just 1 year I would so willingly give up the use of my left leg? But I no sooner said that than he reached up with his other hand, clamped mine between his, and he said, son, we have to do this. The bad news is, if it's as extensive as we think it is, there's a good chance you're going to lose some of the mobility of your right leg. You're probably going to lose the control of your bowels and your bladder. And there's a very good chance you're going to end up sexually impotent. That was just before my 24th birthday. The resident who had been with me for the 2 weeks of tests, when everybody left, he sat on my bed. My wife was on one side and he was on the other side, and they just held me. They didn't say anything. They just held me. And when I finally quit shaking, he said, Terry, we don't know what's going to happen. We've never seen anything like this. But what we do know is you cannot expect to come out of this one whole. The name of my book is The Hell I Can't. I didn't know how to win. I didn't think I could win. But I knew when it was time to stand and fight. And that's why the name of the book is The Hell I Can't. And it explores the journey of me discovering who I was. They went in the next morning when they opened up the pelvic area. They said, Lord, my colon was just perforated. They said, there weren't any holes in it. It was like a sieve. So they pulled my bowels out, clipped them, sewed them to my tummy. Said, you're going to go to the bathroom in a plastic bag the rest of your life. A month later, they did that big one. I was on the table for 13 and a half hours, took 27 units of blood. When they quit because they were losing me. When I come out of the coma 4 days later, they went in to finish it. That didn't work. 6 weeks later, they did another one. That didn't work. About a month later, they did another one, and that didn't work. 4 weeks after that, they started up here an inch and a half wide and took all the tissue out of my back and buttocks so they could see my spine. They took out all the tissue and threw it away so they could see my spine and put me in a body cast for 6 months and laid me on my back. And that didn't work. I had that infection for 11 years. I had 27 major surgical procedures on my spine and abdomen. They did things to my body a person's not supposed to recover from. I got letters from the finest doctors in the world of the insurance company saying what Terry McBride has is not curable and he will be left with significant permanent disability. I'm going to be 70 years old this week and I don't have a bad back. I'm not recovering from a bad back. I haven't learned to live within my human limitations, and I took the prayer they gave me that said I needed to accept the things that I could not change, and I put it in the trash and put a new one up that said, with God, all things are possible. I invite you this morning to get underneath my words. If I say something that's different than you're used to, if I'm a little more in your face than you're used to, forgive me that. I only got a half hour. When I speak to you about your power and authority on this physical plane, it's not because I read a few books. I got to prove it to myself. But this morning isn't about how to use these principles to heal a physical challenge. And of course, that's where Unity started, with Myrtle Fillmore healing tuberculosis. This morning, I want to talk with you about the mystical history of Unity. Where does this stuff come from? Did it just, you know, one day pop up with Jesus? And this is a real condensed mystical history. I mean, there's probably 10,000 books on mysticism, but this is my take. Because my take, as I study, has always been, how do you grow corn with this stuff? I'm not interested in the theory about what happens. You do this and use this when you die, you go to a better place. I was never very interested in that. I think what Jesus came to teach us was, hey, use these principles and this becomes the better place. Behold, the kingdom of heaven is at hand. The oldest living religion is the Hindu faith. When I first started studying the Hindu traditions, it looked real confusing. They got a God for everything. But then I began to understand that the foundation for the Hindu teachings is everybody is different. So they've structured their spiritual practices, if you will, so you can start to relate to God based on where your priorities are. If you're a woman and you're looking to get pregnant and raise a family, they got a statue of a god or a goddess whose sole purpose is to help you get pregnant and have healthy babies. If you're a farmer, they got a statue of a god or goddess whose sole purpose is to help you grow successful crops and have a successful harvest. They allow people to get involved in their spirituality based on their own personal priorities and their own aspirations. And then if you begin to, you know, move up in the Hindu teachings, you get exposed to the mystical teachings within the Hindu faith. But only a select group of people could ever study that. Because before you could study the mystical teachings within the Hindu teachings, you had to be of the right caste system. You had to have a sponsor. You had to have jumped through all the hoops and knew all the sacred handshakes and all the passwords so you could get into the back room. And you had to be male. So only a very select group of people could go study the mystical teachings. But if you could study them, this is what they held. This is out of a wonderful book called The Magic and Mysticism of India. In the Hindu teachings, it is held that the entire universe is controlled by a mental principle that can be translated as creative mind. And they go on and say that each individual is possessed of a portion of this creative mind. And they hold that when we discipline our creative mind enough, it has the power of materializing physical creation directly itself without the need for physical activity. It's kind of wordy, and what it means is you have a creative mind within you, and if you discipline it enough, you can do even greater works. You can heal the sick, raise the dead, walk on water. You can create material representations in form without the need for physical activity. And they go on and say the achievement of this is said to be part of our mental inheritance to be used when we evolve sufficiently to make use of this God-like ability. So the Hindu teachings hold that when you get up and study these mystical teachings, that your mind has the power to create, and that that's what it means to be made in the image and likeness of God. That idea that in the beginning was God, and the Word of God, and the Word of God was made manifest into form. That's what the Hindu teachings hold, if you can reach up into the mystical teachings. But a very select group ever was exposed to that. And you could only use these principles on your spiritual needs. You couldn't use them on your human needs. The next in the lineage, from my point of view, is the Jewish tradition, started by Abraham or Abram, depending on how you want to pronounce it. And he lived in this town where there was all kinds of different religions. And one day he got this revelation that there's only one God and one God who does everything. And that was the first time they came up with this idea of what's called a monotheistic God, one God that does the whole thing. And then out of that revelation came the 12 tribes of Israel, which then moved on to Christianity and the Muslim faith, because the Muslims believe that they're one of the lost tribes of Israel. In the Jewish faith, like most traditions, most spiritual traditions, they start off with the rules. You know, we have that in unity. You know, we're so enamored with the rules before you can really be, you know, you got to hold your palms up so you can be receptive. You got to have your feet flat on the floor so the energy from Mother Earth flows up through us. We got to breathe in through your nose, out through your mouth. You raise our kundalini energy. We have to do all the stuff before you're holy. You have to forgive enough. You have to let go enough. You have to be willing enough. And all that stuff infers that you're not holy now. Well, the Jewish faith was like that. They had their rules. So I think they're in the Old Testament. There are 613 of them that if you have to follow these 613 rules before you can be a good Jew. But if you could follow those rules, you might begin to be exposed to the mystical teachings within Judaism, which is usually held to be in the Kabbalah. But again, you couldn't go study these mystical teachings in the Jewish tradition unless, of course, they didn't believe in the caste system. They're way beyond that. But you did have to prove that you had Jewish heritage on both sides of your family for 5 generations. Sounds a lot to me like the caste system. Anyway, and then you had to have jumped through all the hoops and knew all the right handshakes and have a sponsor so you could get into the secret room. And of course, again, you had to be male. So a very select group of people ever studied, got to study the Kabbalah. But if you could study the Kabbalah, you would find that the whole purpose of the mystical teachings in Judaism is to heal the apparent spiritual separation, the broken chalice. See, the Jews come from, I think that's where we got this fall from grace. The Jews come from, we used to have our act together when we were one with God. But as soon as we came here in form, we blew it. We fell from grace. It's that idea of original sin. You got to go fix yourself before, you know, because now you're broken. And so the whole purpose of these mystical teachings in Judaism is to heal this broken chalice. It's called kovana. The technique is called kovana. Mystical intention in prayer. very similar to what we would call in Unity a primitive prayer. But again, you could only use these principles on your spiritual needs. And then along comes a guy named Isaac Luria. I know it's kind of dry, but it gets a really good point, so hang in there with me. Then along comes a guy named Isaac Luria, who's credited as being one of the three most influential teachers in the history of the Kabbalah. But when you get to Luria, it says this. But Luria's doctrine of mystical intention in prayer does not stop there, just on these to fix your spiritual needs. For Luria's doctrine of mystical intention in prayer stands directly on the borderline between traditional mysticism and magic. And magic, they weren't talking sleight of hand. In the old days, magic was when you healed the sick, raised the dead, when you used these principles on your human needs and your human aspirations. That was called magic. When you demonstrated your power in the physical realm, called magic. And when he brought the idea, you can use these principles on what's important to you, there was this big brouhaha. Oh, no, you can't. That's probably your ego talking. Oh, no, ego hadn't been made wrong yet. So they probably had another word. See, this is what happens. We come here and get inspired about who we are, and then we got great teachers that say, but you can't use it on this, and you can't use it on this, and you can't use it on this. Jesus said all things are possible if you believe they are. We get confused because what we do is we read a little of Unity, we get involved in Unity, and then we study a little of this and study a little of that, study a little of that, and we think we're really wise because we've studied all these things, and now we don't know what to do anymore because they disagree. So what do? We let go and let God. Jesus never said, let go and let God. Jesus said, it's done as you believe. He never said, it's done as you let go of. It's challenging. But when Luria brought this idea that you could use these principles on your physical needs, it was a huge shift. I remember when I was in the hospital for the 16th or 17th surgery on my spine, they sent me to see a psychiatrist. He read letters from the doctors to the insurance company saying what I had was not curable, that I'd have a colostomy the rest of my life. And I said, I don't want to believe like you. I'm going to get well. And he looked right at me and he said, your need to get well is ego-driven. It can be challenging to stand up and believe in your dreams. Oh, not if you go use it right away and it happens, then we say, thank you, God. But when you try and fail and 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 try and fail, I guarantee somebody you love will come up and look at you in the eye and say, perhaps the healing you're looking for may not include the healing of your body. They may not want to put you in a box as much as saying, oh, face reality. No, they don't do that anymore. We just come in and say, perhaps the healing you're looking for may not include the healing of your body. Perhaps God has a bigger plan for you than you just getting well. Perhaps this is some sacred contract you made before you came in, before your life's purpose can be fulfilled. You have to fulfill the contract. I don't want to. I just want to go to the bathroom the way I used to go to the bathroom instead of in a plastic bag. That's your ego talking. It can be challenging. It's said in the mystical writings. Well, let me read this. In the 13th century, a renowned Hebrew scholar named Moses ben Malmon. Now notice, he's a Hebrew scholar, a scholar of the language. He's not a scholar of the Jewish dogma. And he wrote a book called A Guide for the Perplexed. Sounds like a book we could use today. And he opens his book with this. The phrase, let us make man in our image, signifies not a physical likeness, but an intellectual likeness. You have in your mind part of the mind of God, which ties back to the Hindu teachings that says the universe is run by creative mind, and you have a portion of this creative mind. Throughout history, there have been writings that infer to your magnificence, infer to your power, but it's always been buried. And then it's said that about 3,500 years ago, this need to explore these principles got past all these little secret groups, like the secret teachers in the Hindu, the secret teachings in the Kabbalah, that about 3,500 years ago, this need sort of surfaced. And what happened was what I call the ancient mystery schools. The Essenes in the Middle East, the Druids in the United Kingdom, the school of Isis for women in Egypt, the Magi in Persia. And like today, these mystery schools taught different paths, but within each of them was the secret of power and authority. But again, only a few people studied those. And it is said in the mystical writings that these teachers all were connected at some level. They knew the top leaders of these organizations were all connected by a thread of, it's different things. And it is said that about 3,000 years ago, these teachers decided it was time to take these secret teachings to the entire world. And in the mystical writings, it is said that a call went out to an ascended master. Look past the words. These aren't words that you and I might use growing up in a traditional Christian church. These are words that are used within the mystical writings. Just get underneath them. A call went out to an ascended master who was willing to come again and teach these secret teachings to the world. And in the mystical writings, that call was answered by Jesus. In the New Testament, in the original Greek, the three guys that come to visit Jesus at his birth are not called the three wise men. In the original Greek, they're called the masters of Magi. And the mystical significance of these three masters coming from three different places to acknowledge the birth of Jesus was to symbolically acknowledge that finally these secret teachings will be made available to humanity. What unity is about teaching freedom, power, and authority to the human race. And it can be challenging. Because there are some wonderful teachers that would say, don't be too specific, you may limit God. I might as well do it. Jesus never said God has a plan for you. What Jesus said was, as ye believe, so shall it be done unto you. He didn't say, as ye believe, so shall it be done unto you, unless God has a bigger plan for you. He didn't say, as ye believe, so shall it be done unto you, unless, of course, you've got some karmic debt you need to work off. What he said was, whatever you ask for in prayer, believing you shall have it, you shall have it. The responsibility for whether you and I get what we want is in our belief, not in some divine plan. And it's challenging to step up and do that. It's more easy to think, well, maybe there's a lesson in here. You know, maybe life is about having lessons and opportunities for growth. Jesus never said any of that. You and I stand on a threshold where we, because of this center, not only learn how to use these tools within ourselves, we learn how to take these tools to the world. You see, I think Unity Church, this Unity Church, is the answer to your prayer. Where else are you going to explore this stuff? Charles Fillmore is real clear about where these ideas come from. In a book called Unity Treasure Chest, Charles is talking about how challenging it can be to step into our life with authority because of all we've been taught. Don't be too specific. Don't do this. Don't do this. Don't do this. And so what do? We pray for divine right action. When Jesus never said that, he said, ask and it shall be given. Charles Fillmore says this on page 71. He's talking about, so where do we start? And this is what he said. The way to do it is the way Jesus did it. He acknowledged himself to be the Son of God. The attainment of Christ consciousness calls for nothing less on our part than a definite recognition of ourselves as the sons and daughters of God, right here, right now, regardless of appearances to the contrary. Where else are you going to talk about that with? You think you're going to have Thanksgiving dinner with your extended family and be sitting there at the dinner table and say, you know what I got last Sunday? I'm the physical Christ. I doubt it. And I'll tell you something. Charles Fillmore takes it further than just this philosophical, I'm a unique spiritual being living in a, you know, spiritual universe, which means you're the Christ. He takes it further because on page 98 he says, when he's talking about, all right, that's where you start. You got to begin to identify yourself with the truth of who you are instead of these lies. I'm the adult child of an alcoholic parent. I'm the product of a dysfunctional family. My small self and saboteur are always leading me astray. My ego's always trying to separate me from God. People believe that, and we wonder why depression is the number one health challenge in America. Because we believe it. Jesus said, know the truth and it shall set you free. He didn't say forgive enough and it'll set you free. Let go enough. Know the truth. And the truth is that you and I are the living Christ. I didn't know what that even meant when I was sick. When the psychiatrist read the letters, I didn't know what it meant to say I'm not my stuff. I'd never read a book that said I was a spiritual being having a human experience. But I did have enough courage to look them in the eye and say, I'm not my stuff. I'm not my medical records. I'm not your opinion. There's something about me that's whole. And if these books say, if I can find that, I can create health. He said, that's your ego talking. The second thing that Charles says on page 98 of the Unity Treasure Chest. Jesus did not claim to have exclusive use of the supernatural power he used. He knew that others could do what he did if they would only try. And he encouraged his followers to use the power of faith and the power of thought. For it was our brother who said, the works that I do shall ye do also, and greater works than these shall ye do. What this center offers you is an opportunity to step boldly into your life without coming from I am my stuff. What Paul teaches us every morning, the whole purpose of Paul and your staff is to set an environment where you and I can come together and explore these ideas. What does it mean to be God expressing as woman? What does it mean to be God expressing as man? But through doing that, we begin to own within ourselves the truth that we are free. And then it's not just enough to know the truth. We must apply it. For it was Jesus who said, faith without works is dead. You need to apply these to your dreams and through your demonstrations. You will get an experience of who you are that's even bigger than your dreams. I don't know what you're going through. This is a challenging time for a lot of people. A lot of people in the last few years lost their home, the equity in their home, all kinds of stuff. I don't know what you're going through. I don't know how many loving people have patted you on your back and blown in your ear and said, well, perhaps this is some sacred contract or whatever else they tell you that infers you need to accept your human limitations. What I do know is who you are. What I do know is that you are powerful beyond measure. Even if you don't know that about yourself yet, I know that about you because I had an opportunity to prove it to myself. This center is about you and your dreams. And the way you begin to internalize this stuff and make it part of the fabric of your existence, in my opinion, isn't just showing up at church once in a while. It's about getting involved. This center offers you the opportunity to get involved. I remember when I used to go to church and sit in the back, and as soon as it was over, I was out of there. And then one day I decided I need to own this stuff. And so the first thing I did was start volunteering. Not big stuff. At my church, you could volunteer to be a greeter, and you only had to commit for 2 weekends. I committed as a volunteer. And you know what I found? The people, when they came in, they loved me as much as I loved them. I found by being a greeter that I was part of a bigger community than I ever imagined. I started volunteering. There's so much for you to do. The grounds. If you like cooking, you can be in hospitality. You can be a greeter. What happens is you start to meet people and talk about this stuff other than just Sunday morning in this little hour. You begin to make these ideas part of the fabric of your existence. I remember the first time I invited a friend to come with me to church. It was risky. Like many of you, I grew up in a this is spirituality, and you don't go out. But when I started to invite my friends, what I found was on the way home, we would talk about this philosophy. And because I would talk about it, I began to understand more how it worked for me. Inviting your friends is one of the most important things you can do to make these concepts real for you. And then the last thing I would suggest is to put your money where your mouth is. No offense, but I remember when I used to go to church and just put in, you know, and then I realized one day I spend more going to dinner and having a glass of wine during the week than I do at church. And I wanted to tithe, but I always thought you had to tithe this big amount. And I was starting my own business. I had two children. I was struggling. And I didn't see what I could tithe that amount. But I set a number and said, from now on, I tithe that amount. And what I found was, see, tithing isn't about God. You don't need to bribe God for God to back you up. Jesus already said, it's your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. He didn't say, when you give God money, then it's God's. Tithing is about us. Tithing is about when I begin to take responsibility that this is my church. This is where I'm fed. And when I started to support that, what happened was the ideas and concepts became more real to me. And because they became more real, I could use them. I created health where there was only disease. I know what it's like to have no hope. I know what it's like to spend days and weeks and months with no hope. And I also know what it's like to have a sister or a brother. There weren't Unity chaplains because they didn't have those yet. But I knew what it was like to have a sister or brother come up and in the middle of my pain say, if you can't know it's possible, I can know it for you. You're not alone. What this center offers you is an answer to your prayers. Who am I? What am I here for? I encourage you to get involved. It's an honor for me to stand in your presence. God bless. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. This ministry is funded through the generous contributions of individuals just like you. If you have found spiritual enrichment here, please visit us online at www.unityfortworth.org and make a donation. We thank you for your contribution and affirm with you. Divine love flowing through us blesses and multiplies all that we give and all that we receive.